Part 2. The Storm of the Century. Act 1. We begin with a montage of scenes from Part 1. This ends with the final image, Linoja's predatory tiger's face superimposed upon the intersection at the center of town. 1. Exterior. The center of town. Night. The blizzard is rising toward a state of total fury, with snow falling so fast and hard that the buildings look like ghosts. Drifts are already beginning to pile up against the storefronts on Main Street. As Linoja's image fades, we hear a sound, low at first, then up to full, the town whistle, blowing the emergency signal over and over again, two shorts and one long. On Main Street, we can see a string of moving lights and hear the sound of engines as folks comply. 2. Exterior, Main Street sidewalk with Ferd Andrews. Night. He comes pelting along toward the town hall through the snow, sometimes slipping and falling, then picking himself up again. He makes no attempt to go around the building drifts, but bulls his way straight through. He approaches a group of five or six men who are skiing toward the town hall. One of them is Bill Toomey. Bill Toomey.
Say, Ferd, where's the fire?
Because of Ferd's job, it says little tall VFD right across the back of his parka, this breaks Bill's friends right up. It doesn't take much to amuse island people, let me tell you, and these fellows have probably been having a little storm refreshment. Ferd takes no notice, just picks himself up again and continues running toward the town hall. 3. Exterior, Mike Anderson's store. Night. Battened down for the storm. The porch has already drifted in. The storm shutters rattle on their tracks. Peter Godso's pickup truck and Molly's little car are now little more than snow-covered humps, but in the case of the truck, it's no big deal. Peter's driving days are over. 4. Interior, the constable's office. Night. Hatch is, as we left him, at the end of Part 1, staring up at Peter's dangling legs. Nearby is the overturned chair Peter stood on while he was putting the noose around his neck. 5. Interior. The sign around Peter's neck. Close up. Give me what I want, written all over it, helter-skelter along with the dancing canes. And at the top, like a title, is the complete thought in capital letters so big they almost scream. Give me what I want, and I'll go away. 6. Interior. Resume constable's office. Hatch looks from the dangling legs to Linoge, sitting there in the cell, his stocking feet cocked up on the cot's edge, his faintly smiling face peering out from between his spread knees. Linoge's eyes have gone back to normal, but he projects a terrible quality of hunger and predation just the same. He's locked up, yes, but it's such a ridiculous sham of a cell, with its wood floor and home-welded bars. Hatch is getting the idea that he is the one in trouble, locked up with this tiger in human form. We can take it a step further. The whole town is in trouble. Between the dangling body and the silent, staring Linoge, Hatch starts to lose it. Hatch, what are you looking at? No reply from Linoge. Did you make him do it somehow? Make him write that around his neck and then hang himself? Did you? Nothing from Linoge. He only sits there, looking at Hatch. Hatch has had enough and heads for the door. He tries to do it at a walk, but can't hold on to himself well enough to keep that pace. He begins to hurry, then simply bolts. He grabs the knob, turns it, yanks the door open, and there is a shape out there by the meat counter. It grabs Hatch. Hatch shrieks. 7. Interior. Town hall basement, featuring Pippa Hatcher, close up. In one hand, Pippa holds a tail, actually a rolled-up hanky, with a pin sticking out of it. She walks slowly toward a piece of paper that has been taped up to the wall. On the paper, Molly Anderson has drawn a smiling donkey. Gathered around Pippa, calling Warmer and Colder are all but one of Molly's daycare pupils. Ralphie, Don Beals, Harry Robichaud, Heidi St. Pierre, Buster Carver, and Sally Godso, who has become fatherless, but fortunately doesn't know it yet. Frank Bright is sleeping on a cot nearby. Behind the children, we see Cat Withers, Melinda Hatcher, and Linda St. Pierre making beds. standing nearby, holding piles of blankets, are George Kirby, Henry Bryant, and Robbie Beals. Robbie doesn't look happy about it. Carla Bryant comes up to Molly, who is monitoring the festivities. Carla.
Evening sessions now?
Molly. It's sort of fun, but... Pippa manages to plant the tail somewhere in the region of the donkey's ass. Molly. Continues.
When they all finally fall asleep, I intend to track down the nearest alcoholic beverage and make it disappear.
Carla.
I'll pour.
Don Beals.
I want to be next.
Molly to Carla.
Done deal.
She takes the blindfold off Pippa and starts putting it on Don. 8. Interior. The town hall. Upstairs. Night. Ferd Andrews bursts in, wild-eyed and covered with snow from top to tail. Ferd. Top of his lungs.
Lloyd Wishman's dead.
All bustle and activity stops. 40 or 50 faces turn to Ferd. Central to this group is Ursula Godso with her clipboard. 9. Interior, the town hall basement. The kids are still having a good time, shouting warmer and colder to Don Beals as he tries to pin the tail on the donkey, but all the adults have turned toward the sound of that shout. Robbie Beals drops his pile of blankets and heads up the stairs. 10. Interior, the constable's office. Night. Hatch grapples with the shape, hysterical with fear until... Mike.
Stop it, Hatch. Whoa! Whoa!
Hatch stops it and looks up at Mike, his terror becoming relief. He hugs Mike tightly, does everything but rain kisses on Mike's face. Mike.
What's the...
Then, without the distraction of being grappled by his rather overweight second-in-command, Mike sees what the trouble is. His face fills with wonder. He walks slowly past Hatch to the dangling body. He looks at it, then looks at Linoge. Linoge smiles back at him. 11. Interior, the town hall. Features Ferd. Night. Ferd.
Lloyd Wishman's killed himself. Chopped his face in two with an axe. Oh, God, it's awful. Blood everywhere.
Robbie comes upstairs. His wife, Sandra, a plain little thing, is there, and she grabs ineffectually at his shoulder, probably wanting some comfort. He yanks her hand off him without so much as a look, pretty much the way he treats her even in ordinary circumstances, and goes to Ferd. Ferd, babbling.
I ain't never seen nothing like it. Knocked his own brains right out, and he rode on the side of the new pumper. Didn't make no sense.
Robbie grabs him, shakes him.
Get hold of yourself, Ferd. Get a damn grip.
Ferd quits babbling. It's so quiet now you could hear a pin drop, except, of course, for the ceaseless whoop of the storm outside. Ferd's eyes are filling with tears. Ferd.
Why would Lloyd chop his head in two, Robbie? He was going to get married come spring.
12. Interior. The constable's office. Night. Hatch. Also babbling.
I just went out to use the can and get a fresh coffee. He was fine then. But he kept looking at him like a snake looking at a bird. He...
Mike looks at Linoge. Linoge looks back. Mike.
What did you do to him?
No reply. Mike turns to Hatch. Mike. Help me get him down. Hatch.
Mike. I don't know if I can.
Mike. You can. Hatch gives him a pleading look. Linoge. Very pleasant.
Let me out and I'll help, Michael Anderson.
Mike looks at him, then back at Hatch, who is pale and sweaty, but Hatch takes a deep breath and nods. Hatch.
Okay.
13. Exterior. Behind the store. Night. A snowmobile pulls up next to the loading dock, and two men, bundled up in heavy nylon snowsuits, clamber off. They have rifles strapped over their shoulders. It's Kirk Freeman and Jack Carver, the next watch. They go up the steps. 14. Interior, the constable's office. Mike and Hatch have just finished putting a blanket over Peter. We can see Godso's fisherman's boots poking out when a hammering on the back door begins. Hatch gasps and lunges for the desk where the pistol sits beside the makeshift sign, which the men took off the suicide's chest. Mike grabs Hatch's arm. Mike, relax. He goes to the door and opens it. Kirk and Jack come in with snow swirling around them, stamping their feet.
Kirk Freeman. Right on time, by God, storm or no...
Sees the blanket-covered corpse.
What? Mike, who's that?
Jack Carver, sick to his stomach.
Peter Godso. I recognize the boots.
Jack turns to look at Manoj. Kirk follows his gaze. These men are new to the situation, but still understand instinctively that Manoj has been a part of what has happened. They feel his power. In the corner, the CB radio crackles. Ursula, radio voice.
Ike, come in, Mike, and have a bad sit. Town hall. Lloyd Wish.
Gency.
Emergency.
That last word, at least, comes through clearly. Mike and Hatch exchange a startled, worried look. What now? Mike goes to the shelf where the CB sits and snatches up the microphone. Mike.
Ursula, say again. Say again, please. And go slow.
The roof antenna's snapped off and I'm barely picking you up. What is your emergency? He lets go of the button. There is a tense pause. Hatch reaches past him and turns up the volume. Sound of static. Then, Ursula, radio voice.
Oid Schman, Ferd says, Robbie Beals, Henry Bright, have, can hear me?
Mike looks frustrated, then has an idea. Mike, to Hatch. Go out front and get her on the Island Services CB. Come back as soon as you know what her trouble is. Hatch. Right. He starts away, then looks back doubtfully. Hatch, you'll be okay. Mike, he's locked up, isn't he? Hatch looks more doubtful than ever, but he leaves. Kirk Freeman.
Mike, do you have any idea what's going on here?
Mike holds up a hand as if to say, not now. He reaches into his coat pocket and brings out the Polaroids he took at Martha Clarendon's house. He shuffles through them until he finds the one from over the door. He lays this down in the corner of the paper he and Hatch took from around Peter Godso's neck. They are identical. Even the drawing of the cane over Martha's living room door looks the same as the ones dancing on the sheet of paper. Jack Carver.
What in God's name is happening?
Mike starts to straighten up, then sees something else. 15. Interior. The open power book, from Mike's point of view. The entire grid of Hatch's crossword has been filled in with variations of give me what I want and I'll go away, plus the little cane icons in the black squares. 16. Interior. Resume constable's office. Mike.
I'll be damned if I know.
17. Interior. The town office with Ursula. Night. She's working the CB microphone for all it's worth. Behind her, looking anxious, are a number of men and women, Sandra Beals and Carla Bright among them.
Ursula. Mike, are you there?
Molly, also understandably worried, works her way through the knot of onlookers. Molly.
Can't you get him?
Ursula.
The wind's knocked the damned antennas down. Over here... Over there, all over the island, most likely.
Hatch, staticky radio voice.
Ursula, do you read me? Come on back.
Ursula.
I'm here. I read you. You getting me, Alton Hatcher?
Hatch, radio voice.
You're breaking up some, but it's better than it was. What's your problem?
Ursula.
Ferd Andrews says Lloyd Wishman has killed himself over at the firehouse.
Hatch, radio voice.
What?
Ursula.
Only it doesn't sound like any suicide I ever heard of. Ferd says Lloyd cut his own head open with an axe. And now Robbie Beals and Henry Bright have gone over there. To investigate, Robbie said.
Hatch, staticky radio voice.
And you let him go?
Carla takes the mic from Ursula. Carla, there was no way to stop Robbie. He practically shanghaied my husband. And there could be somebody there. Where's Mike? I want to talk to Mike.
18. Interior. The island services vehicle with hatch. He sits behind the wheel, holding the mic and thinking this over. Events are spinning out of control here, and Hatch knows it. At last, he raises the mic to his lips again. Hatch. I'm calling from the truck. Mike's inside. With the man who... you know, the prisoner. Carla. Very staticky voice.
You have to send him down there.
Hatch. Well, we got us a little bit of a situation right here, you see, and...
19.
Interior. The town office. Night. Molly grabs the microphone from Carla. Molly.
Is Mike all right, Hatch? You come on back and tell me.
20. Interior. The island services vehicle. With Hatch. Poor guy actually looks relieved. Here, finally, is a question for which he can provide a satisfactory answer. Hatch.
He's fine, Moll. That's a big 10-4. Listen, I have to go. I'll pass on the message. This is Island Services.
He lowers the mic, looking simultaneously perplexed and relieved, then racks it. He opens the door and gets out into the howling storm. Mike has parked the vehicle next to Godso's truck. Now, as Hatch looks up, he sees Linoja's ghastly, grinning face peering out at him from the snow-caked driver's side window of the pickup truck. Linoja's eyes are dead black. Hatch gasps and staggers backward. He looks at the window of the truck again. Nothing there. Must have been his imagination. He starts toward the porch steps, then turns and looks back, like it, trying to catch one of the other children moving in a game of red light. Sees nothing. Goes on.
21.
Interior. Linoj, close up. Grinning. He knows perfectly well what Hatch saw in Godso's truck.
22.
Exterior. The fire station. Night. The side door is open. Ferd didn't bother to close it when he fled the sight of his partner's corpse, and the emergency lights inside the garage are throwing their glow out onto the snow. A headlight appears. A waspy whine of a snowcat accompanies it. The snowcat pulls up. Robbie gets out from one side, the driver's side, naturally, and Henry Bright from the other.
Henry. I don't know about this, Robbie.
Robbie.
You think we can wait for Anderson on a night like this? Someone's got to take charge, and we happen to be the ones on the scene. Now, come on.
Robbie strides in through the open side door, and after a moment, Henry Bright follows.
23.
Interior. The firehouse garage. Robbie is standing to one side of the nearest pumper. His hood is pushed back, and he has once again lost most of his pompous authority. In one hand, he holds his little gun, and now he waggles the barrel at the floor. Henry looks, and the two men exchange an uneasy glance. Ferd left bloody tracks when he fled. Robbie and Henry are both reluctant now, but as Robbie pointed out, they're on the scene. They walk around the back of the pumper.
24.
Interior. Robbie and Henry. As they come around the pumper, their eyes widen and their faces knot with revulsion. Henry claps both hands over his mouth, but that isn't going to keep it in. He bends out of the frame, and we hear the sound of vomiting, sort of like the sound of music, only louder. Robbie looks at
25.
Interior, the bloody axe, from Robbie's point of view. It lies on the floor beside one of Lloyd Wishman's boots. The camera travels up the side of the pumper to the words printed there in paint as red as blood, "Give me what I want, and I'll go away."
26.
Interior, Robbie Beals. Close up, wide-eyed, beginning to pass fear and perplexity and into the land where panic dwells and really bad decisions are made.
27.
Exterior, angle on Atlantic Street. Night. The storm is howling. We hear a loud, rending crack, and a tree branch falls into the street, crushing the snow-covered roof of a parked car. Conditions are still getting worse.
28.
Interior, the constable's office.
Jack Carver and Kirk Freeman are looking at Linoge, fascinated. Mike is still standing by the desk, looking at the weird crossword puzzle on the power book. He's still got the Polaroids in his hand. When Jack takes a step toward the cell, Mike speaks without looking up. Mike, don't go over there. Jack stops moving at once, looking guilty. Hatch comes in through the market, shedding snow at every step. Hatch, Ursula says Lloyd Wishman's dead over at the firehouse. Kirk Freeman.
Dead? What about Ferd?
Hatch. Ferd's the one who found him. He says it's suicide. I think Ursula's afraid it might be murder. Mike, Robbie Beals took Henry Bright over there to investigate, I guess.
Jack Carver claps his hand to his face. Mike, however, hardly reacts. He's holding on to his cool and thinking furiously.
Mike, street's still passable? What do you think?
Hatch,
in a four-wheel drive? Yeah, probably until midnight. After that,
Hatch shrugs, indicating who knows.
Mike, you take Kirk and go on over to the fire station. Find Robbie and Henry. Keep your eyes open and be careful. Lock the place up, then bring them back here.
Long look at Linoge.
We can keep an eye on our new pal while you do that, can't we, Jack?
Jack.
I don't know if that's such a good idea.
Mike. Maybe not, but right now it's the only idea.
I'm sorry, but it is.
None of them look really happy, but Mike is the boss. Hatch and Kirk Freeman head out, zipping up their coats. Jack has gone back to looking at Linoge. When the door is closed, Mike starts shuffling through the Polaroids again. Suddenly he stops, looking at 29. Interior. The Polaroid of Martha's chair, close up. Bloody and spooky as an old electric chair, but empty. Mike's hands shuffle to the next photo of the chair. In this one, the chair is also empty.
30. Interior. Mike. Close up. Surprised and puzzled. Remembering.
31. Interior, Martha's living room with Mike. Flashback. He has just pulled the drapes across the broken window and anchored them with the table. He turns back to Martha's chair, raises the Polaroid, and triggers it.
32.
Interior, the wolf's head cane. Close up. Flashback. It stares at us with its bloody teeth and eyes like a ghost wolf in a stroke of lightning, then fades.
33.
Interior. Resume Constable's office. Features Mike.
He's got 3-2 pictures of Martha's chair, side by side.
Mike.
It's gone.
Jack.
What's gone?
Mike doesn't answer. He shuffles a fourth photo out of the stack. This is the one featuring the message written in Martha's blood and the rudimentary drawing of the cane. Mike looks slowly up at Linoge.
34.
Interior. Linoge. He cocks his head and puts his forefinger beneath his chin like a girl being coy. He smiles a little.
35.
Interior. Resume Constable's office. Mike walks toward the cell. As he goes, he hooks a chair to sit in, but his eyes never leave Linoge's face. He's still got the Polaroids.
Jack. Nervous.
Thought you said to stay away.
Mike. If he grabs me, why don't you shoot him? Gun's there on the desk. Jack glances that way, but makes no move for the pistol. The poor guy looks more nervous than ever.
36.
Exterior. The island docks. Night. They have been pretty well erased by the pounding ocean.
37.
Exterior, the headland lighthouse, night. It stands straight and white in the sheeting snow, its big light going round and round. Waves crash high around it.
38.
Interior, lighthouse control room, night. It's completely automated and empty. Lights blink and flash. The sound of the wind outside is very strong, and the anemometer is flickering between 50 and 63 miles per hour. We can hear the place creaking and groaning. Wave spume splatters the windows and beads up on the glass.
39.
Exterior, the lighthouse, night. A big wave, a monster like the one that destroyed Peter Godso's warehouse, strikes the headland and all but inundates the lighthouse. 40. Interior. Lighthouse control room. Night. Several windows shatter and water sprays across the equipment. The wave withdraws and everything continues working, so far at least. 41. Exterior, the side of the firehouse. Night. Robbie Beals and Henry Bright come out, shoulders hunched against the storm. They're not the men they were when they went in. Robbie is especially shaken. He takes out a huge ring of keys. Robbie has keys to almost everything on the island, town manager's prerogative, and begins to fumble through them, meaning to lock the door. Henry puts a tentative hand on his arm. Once again, both men shout to be heard above the howl of the storm. Henry, shouldn't we at least check upstairs, see if anyone else? Robbie, that's the constable's job. He sees the look Henry is giving him, the one that says, you sure changed your tune, but he won't back down. It would take a lot more men than Henry Bright to get Robbie upstairs after what they just saw downstairs. He finds the right key and turns it in the lock, securing the firehouse. Robbie, we ascertained that the victim is dead, and we have secured the scene. That's enough. Now, come on, I want to get back to the... Henry, pedantic, fussy. We never really made sure he was dead, you know. Never took his pulse or anything. Robbie, his brains were all over the running board of pumper number two. Why in God's name would we have to take his pulse? Henry, but there might be someone else upstairs. Jake Civiello. Dwayne Pulsifer, maybe. Robbie, the only two names written on the duty board were Third Andrews and Lloyd Wishman. Anyone else in there would likely turn out to be a friend of that Linoge, and I don't want to meet any of his friends, if it's all the same to you. Now, come on. He grabs Henry by the coat and practically drags him back to the snowcat. Robbie fires it up, guns it impatiently as he waits for Henry to clamber in, then turns it in a circle and heads back for the street. As he does, the Island Services four-wheel drive comes trudging out of the storm. Robbie corrects his course, meaning to go around, but Hatch sees his intention and cuts him off neatly. 42. Exterior. Features snowcat and Island Services vehicle. Night. Hatch gets out of his vehicle, flashlight in hand. Robbie opens the canvas-sided door of the snowcat and leans out. He has recognized Hatch and has regained his previous hectoring authority. Once again, everyone shouts to be heard over the sound of the wind. Robbie. Get out of my way, Hatcher. If you want to talk, follow us back to the town hall. Hatch. Mike sent me. He wants you over at the constable's. Henry, you too. Robbie. I'm afraid that's impossible. We have wives and children waiting at the town hall. If Mike Anderson wants either of us to stand to watch later, that's fine. But for the time being... Henry. Lloyd Wishman's dead. And there's something written on the side of one of the fire trucks. If it's a suicide note, it's the weirdest one I ever heard of. Kirk comes around to the front of the Island Services truck, holding his hat down with both hands. Kirk. Come on. Let's get going. This ain't no place for a discussion. Robbie. Annoyed.
I agree. We can have our discussion back at the town hall, where it's still warm.
He starts to close the door of the snowcat. Hatch grabs it. Hatch. Peter Godso's dead, too. Hung himself. Pause. He also left a weird suicide note. Robbie and Henry are dumbfounded.
Hatch. Mike asked me to come get you, Robbie Beals, and that's what I'm doing. You come on and follow me back to the store. I don't want to hear any more sass about it.
Henry to Robbie.
We better do it.
Kirk.
Cough, you better do it. Hurry up.
Henry.
Peter Godso. My God in heaven, why?
Robbie is being driven in a direction he doesn't want to go, and he hates it. He grins without humor at Hatch, who stands pudgy and determined behind his flashlight.
Robbie. You're the one who keeps putting that department store dummy on the porch of the store. Do you think I don't know that?
Hatch, we can talk about it later on if you want. Right now, the only thing matters is that we've got bad trouble tonight, and not just the storm. I can't make you pitch in and help if you don't want to, but I can make sure that when this is over, people know you were asked, and you said no. Henry. I'll come, Hatch. Kirk. Good boy.
Henry opens the door on his side, preparatory to getting out and joining Hatch and Kirk. Robbie grabs him by the jacket and hauls him back into his seat.
Robbie.
All right, but I'll remember this.
Hatch, you do that. Did you lock the place up?
Robbie, contemptuously.
Of course. Do you think I'm stupid?
Hatch won't touch that one with a 10-foot pole, although he probably could if he wasn't set on being as diplomatic as possible. He only nods and starts slogging back toward the Island Services vehicle, his flashlight cutting arcs through the falling snow. Henry opens his door again to call after him.
Henry,
can you raise the town hall on the CB? Tell Carla and Sandy we're okay?
Hatch gives him a thumbs up and climbs into the truck. He revs the engine, then pulls slowly around, so he's headed back toward the market, all four wheels whirring and spuming up snow. The snowcat, with Robbie at the controls, follows.
43. Interior. The cab of the Island Services vehicle with Hatch.
Hatch, on the radio.
Ursula? Are you there, Ursula? Come on back.
44. Interior. The town office. There's a good-sized crowd, very anxious, grouped around Ursula. Among them is Ferd Andrews, now out of his coat, sipping a hot drink and wearing a blanket. Also prominent are Molly, Carla, and Sandy, who now has Don with her for comfort.
Hatch. Staticky radio voice.
Sola.
Come on, Ack.
Ursula ignores the voice for a moment, holding the mic against her shoulder and looking uneasily at the crowd, which is hemming her in even more closely now, eager to hear any fresh news. These are her neighbors, sure, but Molly sees the incipient agoraphobic reaction and turns to the crowd.
Molly.
Come on, folks. Give Ursula some room. Back off. If we hear anything, you'll know.
Tess Marchant, joining in.
Move back. Move back. If you don't have anything else to do, go on downstairs and watch the storm on the weather network.
Upton Bell.
Can't. The cable's out.
But they move back and give Ursula some room. She flashes Molly and Tess a look of thanks, then raises the microphone and pushes the transmit button.
Ursula.
You're weak, but I've got you, Hatch. Talk slow and loud. Come on back.
45. Interior. The Island Services vehicle with Hatch.
Hatch.
Robbie and Henry are fine.
Thought you'd want to know that. Come back.
46. Interior. The town hall, featuring Ursula. Sandra Beals and Carla Bright both register relief.
Don, never one to rest for long when there are toys to be destroyed and peers to humiliate, tears free of his mother and hurtles back downstairs.
Don Beals.
My dad's okay. He's the town manager. He can pass a football 9 miles. Last year he sold $1 billion of insurance. Who wants to play monkey?
Ursula.
Is Lloyd Wishman really dead, Hatch?
47. Interior. The Island Services vehicle with Hatch. He hesitates and exchanges a glance with Kirk Freeman. No help there. Hatch knows he must be careful. Deciding what information to give out and what to sit on is really Mike's job. He checks the rear view just to make sure the snowcat's still behind him.
It is.
Hatch.
I don't know all the details yet, Earth. Just tell Sandy and Carla their boys will be a while longer. Mike wants them over to the store for a little bit.
Ursula. Very staticky voice.
Why or? Is that locked up? Molly wants.
No.
Hatch.
Can't hear you very well, Earth. You're breaking up. I'll try you again in a little while. This is Island Services. 1060 by.
He hangs up the mic with an expression of guilty relief, sees Kirk looking at him, and gives Kirk a little shrug. Hatch. Hell, I don't know what to tell him. Let Mike do that part. It's what they pay him for. Kirk. Yeah, grocery money with a few bucks left over for lottery tickets. 48. Interior. Mike and Linoge in the constable's office. Night. Mike is sitting in the chair he dragged over. Linoge is sitting on his bunk with his back to the wall and his knees apart. They look at each other through the bars. In the background, by the desk, Jack Carver stands watching them. Mike. Where's your cane? No response from Linoge. You had a cane? I know you did. Where is it? No response from Linoge. Sir, how did you get to Little Tall Island? No response. Mike holds up the Polaroid that shows the message over Martha's living room door. Mike, give me what I want and I'll go away. Did you write that? You did, didn't you? No response. Just what is it you want, sir? No response, but the prisoner's eyes gleam. The tips of his teeth show in that creepy little smile. Mike gives him time, but there is no more. Mike. André Linoge. I take it you're French. There are a lot of people of French descent on the island. We've got St. Pierre, Robichaud's, Bissonnette's. No response. What happened to Peter Garceau? Did you have something to do with that? No response. How did you happen to know he's running pot out of his warehouse? Always assuming that he was. Linoge. I know a lot, Constable. I know, for instance, that when you were at the University of Maine and in danger of losing your scholarship over a D in chemistry during your sophomore year, you cheated on the midterm exam. Not even your wife knows that, does she? Mike is rocked. He doesn't want Linoge to see it, but he can't help it. Mike, I don't know where you get your information, but you're wrong on that one. I was going to. I had a crib sheet, Mr. Linoge, and every intention of using it, but I threw it away at the last minute. Linoge, I'm sure that over the years you've convinced yourself that's the truth, but right now we both know better. You ought to tell Ralphie sometime. It would make a nice bedtime story, I think. How Daddy got through college. Shifts his attention to Jack. You never cheated on an exam in college, did you? Never went to college. And nobody bothers you for pulling D's in high school. Jack is staring, wide-eyed. Linoge. They still put you in jail for assault, though, if you get caught. You were lucky last year, weren't you? You and Lucien Fournier and Alex Haber. Lucky boys. Jack. Shut up. Linoge. That fellow just rubbed you guys the wrong way, didn't he? Had kind of a lisp. And that blonde hair, curly like a girl's hair. Not to mention the way he walked. Still, three against one. And pool cues. Well, hardly sporting. Linoge makes a tisk-tisk sound. Jack takes a step toward the desk, and his fists clench. Jack, I'm warning you, mister. Linoge, smiling. The kid lost an eye. How about that, huh? You could go and see for yourself. He lives in Lewiston. He wears a paisley eye patch his sister made him. He can't cry out of that eye. The tear duct is toast. He lies in bed late at night and listens to the cars on Lisbon Street and the live bands from the bottle clubs, the ones that can play anything as long as it's Louie Louie or Hang On Sloopy, and he prays to St. Andrew to bring back the sight in his left eye. He can't drive anymore. He lost his depth perception. That happens when you lose an eye. He can't even read for long because it gives him headaches. Still, he had that swishy way of walking and that lisp, and you guys kind of liked the way his hair looked all around his face like it was, although you'd never say that to each other, would you? Kind of turned you on. Kind of wondered what it would feel like to run your hands through it. Jack grabs the gun off the desk and points it at the cell. Jack, shut up or I'll shut you up, I swear. Mike, Jack, put that down. Winoge never moves, but his face has taken on a kind of dark glow. No special contact lenses or special effect tricks here. It's all in his face. Goading. Hateful. Powerful. Winoge. There's another bedtime story for a stormy night. I can see you in bed with your arm around your little boy's shoulders. Buster, Daddy wants to tell you how he put the nasty queer man's eye out with the end of a pool cue. Cause... Jack pulls the trigger of the pistol. Mike falls off the chair he's been sitting in. He utters a cry of pain. Winoge never budges from his place on the bunk, but now Mike is on the floor, face down. Fade to black. This ends Act One.